Texas oil politicians look like real lightweights. But anyway, interestingly enough, the Fleet Group owns a very large percentage of a group that we have paid some attention to, and this, of course, is the J. Peter Grace folks, the Grace Corporation. And the Grace Corporation is interesting for a variety of reasons, one of which is that the Grace Corporation and the Grace people's connections go back to some of the crossovers between American industry and Nazi industry back for quite a ways. But, of course, J. Peter Grace himself is not only a close friend of Ronald Reagan's, not only was he the head of Ronald Reagan's task force on trimming the economy and tightening up the government and cutting government funds so that we can get on with spending money on military stuff, which is, of course, the real work of the Reagan administration, it seems. J. Peter Grace himself, interestingly enough, and as one of our callers mentioned, he actually called and asked him about it on a talk show. J. Peter Grace was responsible for bringing in a man called Otto Ambrose into the United States. Ambrose, spelled A-M-B-R-O-S, was one of the board of directors and a high-ranking muck-a-muck in I.G. Farben during World War II. I.G. Farben was at that time, the directors of I.G. Farben were the only civilians, I think, ever to have been convicted of war crimes because of their participation in the German war effort, to the point of not only the manufacture of various hideous chemicals and important components of the Nazi war machine, but their use of slave labor and literally working people to death at Auschwitz and elsewhere. So Otto Ambrose was one of the men at the top of I.G. Farben, who was actually sentenced at Nuremberg for his war crimes, and is last we heard of him, had been brought into this country by J. Peter Grace a couple of years ago so that his expertise could be used. And when asked about, after protests by Jewish groups, that he would be brought into this country, and when he was asked about what he thought about these protests, he said, well, you Americans, you know, you're so wrapped up with history, you're so concerned about these things, it's something that happened a long time ago, it had to do with Jews, which I thought was probably got the understatement of the Decade Award. Anyway, so here are the Grace Corporation, and of course there's also the connection to the von Brauchitsches, which we might want to mention too.
Yeah, basically, Hitler's chief of staff, Walter von Brauchitsch, was one of the main people involved in laying preparations for the German General Staff to reform itself in anticipation of Nazi defeat, so that they basically could continue their policies after the war. And a book that we've looked at on these broadcasts is called The Nazis Go Underground, and describes von Brauchitsch as the one of the main reorganizers of the German General Staff in anticipation of going underground for the defeat. And his nephew, Eberhard von Brauchitsch, was for a long time the chairman of the board of the Fleet Corporation. Maybe, I guess he was president of the company, that's what he was, of the Fleet Corporation. So, again, the Fleet name is one that's very significant in connection with the Reagan administration, and the presence of the Fleet name and the role of Friedrich Fleet. Now, keep in mind, he was in prison, having been convicted at Nuremberg. He's mining uranium illegally in contravention of the laws of fact that were passed by the military council governing Germany at the time. This uranium is going to fuel the fledgling American nuclear effort. Now, at the same time, South Africa also was mining uranium for both the British and American nuclear efforts, and that lent a great deal of impetus to its nuclear effort as well.
Now, before we get into South Africa, we're going to talk a little bit more about the source that eventually was to supply these South African operations. Another thing to bear in mind, now, we mentioned I.G. Farben several times, but obviously just glossed over it. Long-time listeners probably have I.G. Farben coming out of their ears at this point. Those of you who are not long-time listeners and are interested in finding out some more things about I.G. Farben and other things I'll mention in a moment might check out a book called The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben by Joseph Borkin, also Treason's Peace.
There's a book called Treason's Peace by Howard Watson Ambruster, which you may be able to find. A book which we know you can find is called Trading with the Enemy by Charles Higham, which is currently out in paperback, which we'll talk about I.G. Farben. Failing all of that, if you can't find anything about I.G. Farben, and even if you can, be sure to be tuned in on Sunday, May 26th here on KF. Is going to be one of the main focuses of discussion in Uncle Sam and the Swastika.
Indeed. Now, one of the reasons that I stress this, and again, the Borkin book is interesting because Borkin was an American government official who was involved in trying to track down some of these connections after World War II, and like Alger Hiss, who was involved in some similar things, did not receive a lot of satisfaction for his efforts eventually. And one of the reasons this is so important is to look at this now and to take this out of a sort of a Nazi versus, you know, not Nazi kind of a viewpoint for a moment, and look at the sheer power of mobile international capital. And again, not speaking from a Marxist point of view, speaking as a point of view from somebody who doesn't have much money and who cannot exert control over countries thousands of miles away. The way that a company like IG Farben could literally just be broken up into component parts, be quote unquote rehabilitated and still continue to operate basically the same way as before, as they had operated before, during, and after World War II, despite the fact that they were the main industrial cartel fueling the Nazi war machine, is staggering in its implications. Okay, we're going to read a little bit more here out of the Nuclear Axis. The present-day atomic industry in West Germany consists of a tightly interlocked group of companies backed by certain major banks, which are directly descended from the corporate structure under Hitler, which, as David Irving points out, was responsible for the early success of the Nazis' nuclear project. Many of the nuclear companies are, quote, successor firms of IG Farben. The chemical concern founded in 1925, which by the outbreak of the Second World War was at the center of the international cartel structure and the greatest conglomeration of industrial and military strength ever assembled under a single management. Grote, again G-R-O-T-H, Grote and others were conducting nuclear research on IG Farben contracts during the war.
Okay, now continuing with about the IG Farben and its involvement in the Third Reich's military or nuclear effort, and the continuation of IG Farben elements and their participation in the nuclear industry of the Federal Republic, West Germany. Again, from the Nuclear Axis by Rogers and Cervenka. The Allied Control Council for Germany passed a special law on the dissolution of IG, and it was decartelized along geographic lines. Nevertheless, the individual turnover of Hecht, H-O-E-C-H-S-T, BASF, and Bayer, all successor firms of IG, puts each of them into the top eight West German firms. The three remain interconnected through joint participation in subsidiaries. Their representatives share the leadership of the Chemical Industry Association and head its working committees. They also retain in their top management important participants in IG's wartime operations. Dr. Karl Förster, W-U-R-S-T-E-R, for example, served under Hitler as Wehrwirtschaftsführer, military economic leader, member of the IG Farben Vorstand, the executive board of directors, production chief for inorganic chemicals, and plant leader at the BASF Ludwigshafen plant, which used slave labor from concentration camps. Förster was also involved in the attempted takeover by IG Farben, in collaboration with the Reich government, of the Czech company Prager Verein before the Munich Pact of the 29th of September 1938. In 1952, Förster became the first chairman of the managing board of BASF, and in 1965, chairman of the supervisory board. Several other directors of West Germany's nuclear industry have similar backgrounds. A prominent member of the network of nuclear chemical companies formed by the IG successors and related firms is Nukem, N-U-K-E-M, spelled just like Nukem, which is appropriate. And related firms is Nukem, or Nukem, whose main shareholder is Degussa AG, D-E-G-U-S-S-A. The other shareholders of Nukem are Metallgesellschaft, RWE, a major electricity producer, and Rio Tinto Zinc of Britain. Degussa gained its initial nuclear chemical experience in the Second World War, where it supplied the Nazis with all of the uranium used in their enrichment efforts. Conversion of Degussa's uranium oxide to uranium hexafluoride, the first stage of enrichment, was undertaken by IG Farben. It was Degussa which subsequently fabricated the new Federal Republic's first uranium fuel rods, using the ore illegally obtained by Fleek's organization. Degussa then took the leadership in the fabrication of fuel elements for all types of nuclear reactors. The decisive conceptual advantage in centrifuge research and development, the Zippa centrifuge, was patented in 1957 by Degussa, who thereafter developed it. It was carried to the experimental stage in the 1960s at the Jülich Nuclear Research Center under the scientific control of Degussa metallurgist and fuel element specialist Dr. Albert Bitcher, B-O-T-T-C-H-E-R. And next, the authors here of the Nuclear Axis, Rogers and Cervenka, go on to talk about the primary role which the West German government has played in sponsoring nuclear research, and in turn the emphasis in the West German nuclear program upon acquiring a complete nuclear fuel cycle, in particular with a capacity for uranium enrichment. So uranium enrichment is one of the specialties of the West German nuclear industry, important for our purposes because this specialty was then given to South Africa. German atomic industry has, almost since the beginning of the Third Reich, aimed at acquiring a complete and autonomous fuel cycle within West Germany, particularly the capacity for uranium enrichment. In this, the federal government itself has played a critical role through the German Atomic Commission, the Jülich and Karlsruhe Nuclear Research Centers, and with various forms of support, including credits, subsidies, and loan guarantees. So the Federal Republic, the government of the Federal Republic here, is right in pitching along with the old the corporate structure which backed Hitler here. And one of the things that we've looked at in the past on these broadcasts is the fact that essentially at the end of World War II, the Western industrial democracies, meaning Britain, France, and the United States, sort of waved their hands and said, okay, no more Nazis, and then returned the entire Nazi power structure, basically just seated it again in West Germany. Konrad Adenauer himself worked closely with the Third Reich. The Chancellor of West Germany, Kurt Kiesinger, was a key official with Third Reich radio propaganda. The President of West Germany at the time that Kiesinger was Chancellor was a guy named Heinrich Lübke, who was in charge of approving the blueprints for the extermination camps. And these are merely examples of an ongoing use by the Federal Republic of key, many key officials from the Third Reich, and some more obscure people as well. The current president of West Germany, a guy named Richard von Weizsäcker, is the son of Hitler's deputy foreign minister, and himself served in an elite infantry unit during the invasion of Poland, later represented his father at Nuremberg. So the Third Reich elements are in ascendance in the government of the Federal Republic of Germany, and they in turn are very much involved with promoting this pattern of cooperation between the federal government of Germany, the government of the Federal Republic, and the West German nuclear industry, which, as we're going to see, basically gave a key uranium enrichment process to the government of South Africa. And this uranium enrichment process is what basically makes South Africa the nuclear power that it is today.
Okay, now the next section is going to be talking very briefly about a contact between two corporate bodies, one called STEG, STEAG, which is a West German company, and the other is Eucor, which is a South African company, and that this was a comparatively hush-hush operation, this transfer of technologies, as is mentioned earlier in this portion of the book, that they were had some cover story about the only comparing two different types of processes, and basically that they were saying, oh no, we're not giving them the technology, we're all just going to stand around together and look at the technology together and compare them, which is of course a pretty ridiculous thing to say when you're talking about a country that does have the technology getting together with a country that does not have the technology. Okay, anyway, so here's a section on that and on the South Africa connection. In the absence of the official cabinet, this is West German cabinet, of the official cabinet support, which is an essential prerequisite for a government credit guarantee, funds also had to be found to finance the STEG-Eucor deal. Again, West German to South African transfer of technology. Dr. N. Diederichs, the South African Minister of Finance, took care of this problem. On October 31, 1973, he arrived in Frankfurt for talks with the West German bankers involved in the financing of the West German nuclear industry. His two-week program included meeting with a number of leading West German financial heavyweights. On the afternoon of October 30th, he met Dr. Paul Lichtenberg, chairman of the board of the Commerzbank. That evening, he met Jürgen Ponto, chairman of the Dresdner Bank, and Helmut Hüngsen, a board member. The vice chairman of Metallgesellschaft AG, Kasimir Prinz Wittgenstein, and Paul Ungerer, chairman of the Degussa board. On November 8, there were discussions with Dr. Wilfried Guth of the Deutsche Bank board, and that evening with Dr. Karl Klassen, president of Deutsche Bundesbank, the national bank of the Federal Republic of Germany. On the following morning, November 9, discussions were held with the honorary chairman of the board of Deutsche Bank, Hermann Joseph Abs. The new phase of cooperation between STEG and Eucor was finalized in March 1973. And it should be mentioned just very briefly before we go on to the new section that Hermann Abs is a very interesting character. We have talked about him in the past. One prominent American government official involved in researching the connections between various industrial groups and the Third Reich war machine and the Nazi political machine mentioned the fact that Hermann Abs was Hitler's banker as head of the Deutsche Bank before, during, and after World War II. In other words, the implication being that he was still working for Nazi ideals, although himself not explicitly, I believe, a member of the Nazi Party. after World War II. One of the reasons that he's such an interesting character, not only because of his connections with all kinds of various strange international funding of politically strange activities, but because of the fact that he himself was brought in by Pope John Paul II to oversee the Vatican Financial Tangle Review Board, to be part of the Board of Three overseeing the review of Vatican finances, which was quite interesting because, as we have talked about at length on this show, the Vatican financial mess is due almost exclusively to a bunch of right-wing extremists getting in and messing around with the Vatican funds and using them to fund various fascist political activities all over the world. So, sort of like bringing in the weasel to count the chickens.
Now, one of the interesting things about this particular passage concerns the fact that Hermann adds, well, basically, see Los Altos Hills, and aside from that, Hermann Abs was called in by Pope John Paul II, who himself was at Auschwitz under circumstances which have yet to be clarified, that basically he called in Hermann Joseph Abs to straighten out the Banco Ambrosiano tangle and the inordinate state of Vatican finances. Another fellow he called in to do this was a guy named Philippe de Weck, an official with the Union Bank of Switzerland. Now, Philippe de Weck was not only affiliated with a number of far right-wing political organizations like the World Anti-Communist League, he also was involved with a scam to basically obtain a good deal of money for the South African government. Basically, a plane which supposedly could detect underground oil deposits was to be marketed, and the funds generated through the gullible investors who were going to invest in this thing would then be channeled to South Africa in order to foster South African energy independence. So the Philippe de Weck, along with Hermann Abs, two of the four bankers called in to straighten out the Vatican financing, was also very much involved with the South African government here and the propagation of political reaction in Southern Africa. Now, interestingly enough, the finance minister of South Africa, Dr. Nico Diederichs, is spoken about in the book that Niptuck read you from earlier called The Bruder Bond by Ivor Wilkins and Hans Strydom. And interestingly enough, now Hermann Abs, who was very much involved in the financing of the STIAG deal, which basically, again, the deal in question there was the deal which gave South Africa its uranium enrichment capability. That is the key to South Africa's nuclear capability. That uranium enrichment capability comes from Nazi Germany. And in the Bruder Bond, it describes Nico Diederichs. It says, Dr. Nico Diederichs was one who went across to study, report, and qualified as a Quisling in the Nazis' anti-Comintern training school. And so the finance minister who works with Hermann Abs, again, that quote there from the Bruder Bond by Ivor Wilkins and Hans Strydom, also was one of the South Africans who was dispatched by the Bruder Bond to coordinate activities with the Third Reich. And recall that as a result of that coordination, the Bruder Bond was then reshaped along the organizational pattern of the German Nazi Party. Now, Hermann Abs, a key Nazi banker affiliated with IG Farben, the man who puts forth the venture capital to build the slave labor camps at Auschwitz. He is one of the key fellows in swinging the deal which gives South Africa its nuclear capability. Now, the significance of South Africa's having a uranium enrichment capability and the role that South Africa's nuclear capability is to play in its domestic and foreign policy are covered in the book The Nuclear Axis by Barbara Rogers and Mr. Sivenka. They write, the real threat to the international safeguard system, referring here to nuclear safeguards, the real threat to the international safeguard system lies in the availability of uranium from a supplier more interested in politically advantageous deals with other countries than in the ideal of non-proliferation, and in the existence of nuclear installations which are not subject to inspection under a safeguards agreement. South Africa is a threat to non-proliferation on both counts. Firstly, it is a major uranium producer, with a strong interest in dealing with countries such as Israel, Iran, Brazil, France, and others, which place high priority on obtaining an independent nuclear capability. Secondly, it has the world's only unsafeguarded enrichment plant outside the existing nuclear powers. Not only is the plant itself unsafeguarded, thanks to the understanding between the South Africans and their West German suppliers, but there can be no question of safeguards on the raw material fed into it for enrichment, since the South Africans produce their own uranium and can now carry out every stage in its processing from extraction out of the ore to final enrichment. And worth noting here before continuing with this discussion that the German emigre community, the German community in South Africa played a very important role in establishing the deal which gave South Africa its uranium enrichment. Specifically, a number of key South African military officers, who several of whom were also West German citizens, were allowed undue access to what should have been state secrets concerning West Germany's nuclear capability, and through this access and the cooperation with between the West German government and these individuals, obviously acting on behalf of the South African government, basically this particular deal was swung. But the German community in South Africa had a lot to do with arranging this transfer of uranium enrichment technology from West Germany to South Africa. And again, the authors Rogers and Cervenka continue in The Nuclear Axis. Speaking about, in a discussion here which they talk about the second half of the book, finally, we will look at indications that South Africa is basing its strategy for survival on the development of its own nuclear weapons. We conclude that these weapons, relying as they do on delivery systems supplied by France, West Germany, and other Western countries, are in fact aimed not only at the heart of Africa and the communist menace, unquote, there, but also at the West itself in a calculated maneuver to force it into guaranteeing the future of white minority rule in South Africa. So, with regard to South Africa's nuclear capability, obviously, it puts it in a position to dictate in rather unequivocal fashion to its neighbors, it's the neighboring countries in Africa. It, according to these authors, may also enable them to take a harder line with regard to the West. And, again, something which we speculated about earlier in the broadcast, currently in South Africa, much of the black population are being resettled into so-called tribal homelands. And in the event of an all-out revolution or a great upheaval of some kind, a relatively low-yield, say, tactical neutron warhead might be employed here against some of the black population of that country. And if this seems a little bit far out, again, remember where the South African government comes from. Basically, it's an offshoot of the Third Reich. Its nuclear capability, which we believe, and the authors of this book indicate, seems to be the bottom line with South Africa, is that it now is a nuclear power, basically, and that the linchpin of that nuclear power being their uranium enrichment capability, that comes from West Germany. It comes from the industrialists who, as the authors indicate, formed the corporate structure underlying Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich. It also comes from the government of West Germany, which essentially, just like the government of South Africa, springs directly from Nazi Germany.
Bear in mind, too, lest it sound extreme. And, of course, as we have mentioned, we are not saying this is the case. We're saying this is something to consider and something to talk about and think about. But lest it seem extreme, bear in mind also this is the government that, as was just recently revealed in court in the last couple of weeks, by the admission of their own security forces, in which, for instance, a police commander, upon seeing one woman out of a crowd of several thousand pick up a rock, ordered his troops to fire on that crowd with automatic weapons. I mean, not throw a rock, just bend over and pick one up. One woman out of a crowd of thousands literally were shooting people in the back with automatic weapons as the crowd fled, totally unarmed, apparently quite peaceful, according to all reports. This is the way that the South Africans treat their citizens. If the South African government was pushed back against the wall to the point where they felt in real danger for their power base and perhaps even their lives, who knows how they might react. It's certainly something to think about. Something to brood about, perhaps, even. Okay, we're going to take a break. Dave will be...